So this is this quote that I've had in a meme for a while, and I haven't really shared it that I recall, but I thought about it a lot. It's from Jung. Whatever is rejected from the self appears in the world as an event. I'll say it again. Whatever is rejected from the self appears in the world as an event. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Wow, I'm digesting that.
I know, I've kind of hit you on the spot here. Got, you know, put you on the spot a little bit, but...
Well, an event makes you think it involves the collective. So it's a curious notion to reject something individually and have it manifest in the world as an event.
Now, I'm assuming this is being translated from German. Mm-hmm. So...
You're thinking he's saying like people, whatever people reject, or do you think it's...
Here's how I read it, just literally what he's actually saying, okay, is that whatever is rejected from the self, so whatever is inside you, that you're not coming to terms with. So he's really talking about the shadow. Mm-hmm. That force, that energy, however we want to define it, will manifest in your environment as a person, place, thing, or a happening.
Okay, well, that sounds like everything that anyone's ever repressed.
Yeah, it's the return of the repressed. It's truly the return of the repressed.
Anything that people have tried to ignore or bury sneaks its way back into your life through maybe some disguised form.
Right.
It could also be things that people just haven't dealt with very well, you know, even victim of circumstance.
Mm.
Or trauma.
Yes, I would agree. All of the above.
You know, the tendency to get in cyclical patterns, repeating the same behavior or mistakes.
Sure, sure. So he's describing an action, but he doesn't, at least in this quote, he doesn't go into the mechanism for producing this effect, right?
Right.
This is what I'm most fascinated by, because I see the effect all the time. I see it in the world. I see it in people's lives. I've seen it in my life. I accept this effect as just a rule of the game here. It's, mm-hmm, it's how things work. But how it works, you know, the mechanism, mm-hmm, through which these interior processes manifest outwardly into so-called concrete facts and situations, that's what really, really,
right,
absolutely fascinates me. Because if you come at this notion from the current kind of materialistic scientific mindset, it's nonsensical. It sounds like voodoo, or it sounds crazy. And yet we can all witness this happening if we just pay attention. It is happening.
Mm-hmm.
So this is kind of what I wanted to talk about. It's this idea that we have some ability or force or power within ourselves that keeps creating the world around us.
Right, right, right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What do you think about that?
It sounds kind of like a projector field, you know, of experiences or things that we process. Like, for instance, I always feel like we create and attract experiences that we individually need. Maybe it's just a growth opportunity, something to expand, wherever we are. And that may not be true, but I always feel like there's some kind of wisdom in what's happening or what I'm attracting. like to pay attention, you know?
I like that.
But I don't really like to look at it as like a lesson, because I don't like the kind of punishment and reward sort of thing. To me, it's more
Does a lesson have to involve that?
No, maybe it's a connotation, you know?
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, certainly a lesson can just be a teaching. So for me, maybe it's an energetic phenomenon of creating the atmosphere or the thing, the event was the word that we used. To help you see things differently or process, you know, something. I mean, if in psychology they were talking a lot about the unconscious, you know, making sense of what we do, what we think. I don't know, what are your thoughts? What do you think the phenomenon is of putting that?
I feel that he's describing an aspect of the creative force that is part and parcel of who we are. It's really the imagination that he's describing. The imagination is multifaceted. I would say there's a conscious side to the imagination, and then there is an unconscious side to the imagination. And he's describing the unconscious aspect of the imagination. What I would say in addition to that is that we are always imagining our world into existence. It's not a choice that we have, because it's who we are. We are imagineers. We are creators through the imagination. So we can choose to be as conscious as possible of this, or we can kind of stumble through life thinking that it's not a real thing and imagining that somehow the world is living or creating or affecting us.
Yeah. So it sounds like you're saying too that most of the time we're going around creating, and we don't even realize it. We don't even realize how much influence or power we have over our immediate manifest reality.
Yeah, that, you know, famous quote, the mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. But it's only desperation because they don't realize they're actually powerful. If they did, that wouldn't be the case. They would be creating something very different individually, and certainly if enough people got on that wavelength together, we would create a different collective reality. So when I say imagination, I'm really talking about the fictional construct that we live in and that we think is real. And I put together a few quotes. I just kept a little file of this kind of thing for a while. And they're really cool. They really speak to different parts of this, and they're from mostly literary figures. And I think these are really the true visionaries. They're not usually the true visionaries are not scientists, they're actually artists. The best scientists are artists in their way. So the first is a quote from G.K. Chesterton. He's the person who also said angels can fly because they take themselves lightly. Wonderful, yes. Wonderful mind.
I like that.
He said, literature is a luxury. Fiction is a necessity. So literature could mean nonfiction. It could mean other types of writing, learning, texts, books, that kind of thing. But fiction as a subset of literature is the really vital, important thing. It's a necessity. Without it, somehow he's implying we don't exist. We're not here.
Well, that's the essence of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we had before the written word. Anyway, that's our origins are in story. And did it matter if, like, to Native Americans, if the things, some of the stories, like, perceived now seem far out or fictitious?
Right, you know? Right.
Who is to say what is real and what isn't?
Well, you know, we've been rewatching Northern Exposure,
yes,
which is supposedly takes place in Alaska. I think it was actually filmed in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
This was an early, what was it? It was a early 90s. It was kind of contemporary with David Lynch's Twin Peaks.
Mm-hmm.
But it went on for longer. I think it was like 6 seasons. Anyway, the basic storyline is you have a doctor named Joel Fleischman, who is a New Yorker, and he's just an absolute uber materialist scientist, a doctor at that point in time, the early 90s, and he's interested in wealth and, you know, getting ahead and material comforts and all of that kind of thing. And he encounters in this Alaskan very small town bordered by just a tremendous wilderness is a kind of reputation of everything his life is about. And a lot of it comes from the Native Americans, the Native Alaskans that he encounters, who live in realities that appear to him very often fictitious until right before his eyes they tend to come true.
Right. Yeah. The imagination was extremely strong, a strong player in the unfoldment of events in this world. And you see that actually in these cultures, and sometimes you see it in more rural kind of native cultures that haven't really separated as much from their roots and their land. That's just something interesting that popped into my head about why there may be stronger connections to the power of that imagination and story. We kind of veered off from the quote, which was about, like, fiction.
Well, we're just talking about storytelling, you know. I think the way that a lot of Native cultures interact with the natural environment is the product of a story they tell themselves about the environment. And maybe it's also a product of the story the environment is telling them about itself or about those people. You know, mm-hmm. There's, you know, interactive storytelling. I've spoken in some of my interviews about the work of philosopher Mikhail Bakhtin, who wrote The Dialogic Imagination. It's this idea that we're not just imagining ourselves, we're kind of imagining each other, and we're talking to each other either in the present or through a time lapse, like with another writer who came before you, for example, or another thinker, and that we're constantly informing each other. It's almost as if there's no time. There's an implied notion in his work, if you read it closely, that, you know, the future is acting retrocausally on the past, and it's very, very fascinating. The whole, you know, and this, he was writing this stuff years and years ago, way before that this retrocausality concept became more mainstream. I also wanted to at least mention that when I say storytelling, you could include self-storytelling, the stories that we tell about ourselves, the way that we constantly recreate our circumstances, our lives, by telling ourselves internal stories, the internal dialogue, you know, which in the shamanic way of seeing things is not always like you talking. It can be some kind of mind parasite that's gotten a hold of you and that it's telling you a story about your life that then you go and live because it's hijacking your creative ability. It's forcing you to tell, or you've agreed or whatever, to tell a story about yourself that isn't actually your story. It's something else's story about you.
Right, yeah, that's pretty wild. Also, I think with our personal stories or stories that we tell ourselves, I feel like we don't always know what's completely accurate. I feel like we, you know, some of the stuff we make up. Maybe we thought we experienced something, or we heard something, or maybe through a series of pictures Absolutely. Or things that have been told down, you know, passed down through families, you know. And there's the imagination again, because, well, what do you want your story to be? It seems like sometimes we pick and choose what fits, what resonates, what makes sense.
Oh, I agree totally. I think we're always doing that, again, consciously or unconsciously. Right. You know, we're fitting the puzzle pieces together, and sometimes we're rearranging them and making new puzzles, and sometimes the pieces don't all fit, you know, and it's kind of a weird mishmash, and that's distortion, that's trauma, that's pain, that's our relationship difficulties, that's poverty, you know. We're not really in alignment with our true vision. I do come from a position that we have a kind of true soul vision for who we want to be. And I think we come here with it. It's almost like a soul contract or an agreement with the self. That's what my song Wayward Mariner is all about.
Right.
It's about that soul contract. And in that song, it's someone saying, I'm going to change the world. That was the agreement I made with myself. It's not necessarily me saying that. But that's the singer of the song, or the, you know, the narrator of the lyrics.
Right, like coming in with a mission.
Yep.
I do think we all come in with a purpose and a mission. You know, I mean, maybe some people discover that really quickly, and for some people, you know, they go their whole lives, you know, touching on it, you know, in different, you know, ways, and maybe they find it.
Maybe they find it. So I was going to read another quote. This is Ken Kesey. He wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, was a huge writer in the whole countercultural era, major figure. And it's a short quote. But it's the truth, even if it didn't happen.
Well, people believe it's the truth, then it's the truth, right? Look at our world.
So I'm going to pair that with another quote by Jung, and he's critiquing the rational mind, and it, you know, it kind of makes space for maybe how Ken Kesey's quote might make more sense on some right brain level. So Jung says, we should not pretend to understand the world only by the intellect. We apprehend it just as much by feeling. Therefore, the judgment of the intellect is at best only the half of truth, and must, if it be honest, also come to an understanding of its inadequacy. Mm. So, and what I would add to that quote is, most of the time with skeptics and rationalists and materialists, they do not admit to the inadequacy of their frame of reference, which is the intellect. They're Correct. Completely like they're like intellect addicts. We used to call them like what, bobbleheads, or, you know, we talked about, you know, people who were always into just light, and instead of like the sound current, we would say that they're
info heads,
you know. They're info heads.
Where they'll take in information all day long and thrive off of, you know, information and knowledge alone, like even very fringe things, but don't necessarily, or haven't necessarily cultivated or seek an inner life or do a lot of action in steering their lives in positive change.
Right, like, so you can present, like, we have this Regenetics healing work, which has helped a lot of people. I have a recent interview with author Denby Sheether, where we go into this, and she's describing some of the ways it's benefited her, this work. And she comes from a, you know, a healing, yoga, consciousness background, you know, and yet this work has benefited her in many ways. So we've seen this phenomenon over the years, that you present all of this information about Regenetics to these info heads, who have lots of problems, health problems, relationship problems, financial problems, and they will take in all the information and then do nothing and eventually move on to something else that they want to take in. It's like some kind of, you know, top-heavy imbalance, you know, where they're just going to topple over because their heads are so big and their, I don't know, their hearts, their intuitive capacity are so small that they're just going to, one of these days, they're just going to, like, be Humpty Dumpty. They're just going to fall off a wall and break. You know?
Well, sometimes people have trouble trusting and acting, you know, and so they get stuck in this place of taking information in, like, you know, I need to just read a little more about this, or I need to, you know, and they end up with a stack of self-help books, you know, but have they made one lick of progress, you know, with what they were hoping to.
Right. Or they get sucked into the whole conspiracy rabbit holes inside rabbit holes, and they just go nowhere. Another quote. This is Richard Bach, who wrote Illusions, and I think he was the writer for Jonathan Livingston Seagull. If you will practice being fictional for a while, you will understand that fictional characters are sometimes more real than people with bodies and heartbeats.
So how would you practice being fictional?
Well, before we go there, which, you know, I have thoughts on, we were talking earlier today about NPCs. And all these people out there who seem so asleep and unaware, and, you know, people who will do, you know, biometric fingerprint identification to use Apple Pay, and just these crazy things that people are doing. Mm-hmm. And are they even real? That's a funny way of putting it, because I don't really believe anything is real, but are they in some different category? If this is like a matrix, are they still plugged in? Are they, or are they just illusory aspects of the background? And we hear about such people, or we interact with them, and then maybe they're briefly animated, like a family member who otherwise has no interiority. And then when they leave you, they just dissipate back into the background fabric of the matrix. It's so confusing, because so many of these people that I'm describing just don't seem human to me.
Yeah, and yet you can see them and touch them and talk to them, but this kind of ties in with people living different realities, like these parallel realities. And I mean, there are many, many people that I think you would never, ever cross paths with simply because you're not on the same wavelength. Like, everything in your lives is completely different.
Mm-hmm. I like that person. I like that.
You know, maybe you get a glimpse of them, you know, in a grocery store, or, you know, somewhere in a busy place, but there's no connecting point. It's like being on two different dimensions occurring simultaneously.
I like that. That's very consistent with my understanding of how the imagination would function in a kind of matrix, where an imaginative matrix, because you would be able to create your own reality bubbles and live in those to some extent. And every once in a while, they collide or interpenetrate, you know, yeah. But sometimes they just barely coexist, you know, and so people might be experiencing hell on earth next to an absolute utopian paradise. And we see these types of very incongruent scenarios happening all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well, and that touches back on one of the quotes you mentioned, and it had to do with truth.
Let me see which one that is. But it's the truth, even if it didn't happen. That was the Ken Kesey.
Yes, because everyone has a different truth. And everyone's story creates a different truth in that person. And that's why people believe very different things. It's because they've been telling themselves different stories.
I like that.
But the truth, you can't nullify someone else's truth. I mean, like, it's seems rather individualized.
Yes, I think ultimately it is. I mean, you have people out there discounting that. I mean, most notably in my life, you know, John Lash's work, you know, he basically says if you don't believe in the goddess and Sophia and the earth and everything, then you are lost. I mean, you know, he has a kind
of... But that's cultish, because very, to invalidate very cultish. Anyone else's truth based mm-hmm. on
absolutely.
Religion, politics, spirituality, I mean, you name it. Preferences.
And I think he has no proof that people didn't dream the goddess into being. The whole Gnostic scenario is a kind of forward-moving narrative, but with retrocausality and these other notions of the imagination in play, the dialogic imagination. Who's to say we didn't create the goddess and then we assigned her the agency of having created us, right? So all of these Gnostic concepts go both ways, and I think that, you know, it's easy to think everything just moves forward. Here's a, you know, because we are really in a kind of dream scenario, but I don't want to get into that quote. There's a great Edgar Allan Poe quote here about dreams, but I will leave that for another day. Here's Neil Gaiman. There are people who think that things that happen in fiction do not really happen. These people are wrong.
I agree with him.
So here's another amazing creator who's, you know, Neil Gaiman. If you don't know who he is, look him up. It's G-A-I-M-A-N. But, you know, he's one of our best writers right now. And you don't have to like all of his aesthetics, but he's collaborated with Tim Burton and all kinds of people. And, you know, he really gets it that we are, you know, able to formulate realities within fictions. Writers are really good at this. They're really probably the very best because they're dealing with these etymological and ontological nuances. But he states it very, very beautiful. And this is, I wanted to follow that quote up with another one by world-renowned writer Cormac McCarthy. The truth about the world is that anything is possible.
Well, I think that's true. Absolutely. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine why anyone wouldn't think that is true. But I'm very open-minded.
Yeah, it's good to be open-minded. What he's opening up there for me, speaking of open-mindedness, is this idea that we can create a different reality, a different experience, maybe is a better word. For ourselves as individuals and collectively. Right now, we're being steered by both the mainstream media and the alternative media, including the conspiracy cult, into these ideas that we're moving in one direction. One direction only is the only option that's going to happen, and that is some dystopian reality where we are all transhumanized and, you know, barcoded. I mean, let's get real. That's really a major, major, major narrative that's being forced onto people, whether you're looking at NBC or some channel about, I don't know, the plasma Newsmax apocalypse or who knows what. Just it's the gamut of sources, and they're all pumping out different versions of the same story. And yet a lot of people don't realize it's the same story that's being told. They think that because they're listening to something all quote-unquote alternative, that it must be somehow different from what they're getting from a mainstream news source. And I'm here to tell you, it ain't.
It's not. And look how much of it is still fear-based in the alternative media. It's because fear sells.
Because fear sells. I mean, that's really what we're talking about here.
Gets people fired up. But so, I do think, I mean, for the collective to change, individuals have to change. You can't go out there and proselytize, you know, your beliefs and get people to change. It is a one-by-one inner shift. And if it comes together in a way that, you know, triggers a shift in the greater consciousness field, fabulous.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I mean, that's it really starts in the individual, and it's also an inside job. You know, you have to go in to go out. You know, the you know, escape is an inner journey, if you want to look at it that way. But I'm not even sure we need to escape so much as just wake up to who we are and what our power is.
Right, yeah, and align with our own paths that we're called to, you know. Sometimes that's, you know, just intentionally shutting out all of the chatter from everywhere, from all sources.
Right on, right on. So, Lee, if it's okay with you, I wanted to end with a quote by Tom Montauk, and then when it's done, let's just call it done, okay? Because he kind of summarizes some of the things we've been talking about, and it's a beautiful way to end this little episode.
Sounds
good. So, this is Tom Montauk. He's written a number of books on Gnosticism and the kind of matrix and simulation types of concepts. And this is it. So enjoy. What is the matrix? School or prison, depending on your chosen perspective. On the one hand, it is a hyperdimensional teaching system, accelerating your rate of spiritual evolution by providing you with catalytic experiences in response to your thoughts, emotions, and spiritual composition. On the other hand, many of these experiences manifest as predatory forces, preying upon your weaknesses. Of course, the only way to prevent being manipulated by these forces is to discover, integrate, and transform your weaknesses into strengths, thereby indirectly accomplishing the higher purpose of the matrix, which is to help you transcend it. Nevertheless, these predatory forces possess free will and have their own agenda, which is to expand their power base and sustain themselves by feeding upon humanity's emotional energies, as well as keeping anyone from becoming aware enough to add destabilizing influences to the spiritual prison slash farm they are running here on Earth. The sum total of their hyperdimensional manipulation system may be termed the Matrix Control System. It is a school of hard knocks that weakens the spiritually weak and strengthens the spiritually strong in accordance with their choice to be victims or warriors.